spend as much time as possible to hire that.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? No, great. All right, thank you for being so patient. I'm going to call up the list that I have here. I have Henry Lorenzen, President, State Board of Higher Ed, George Prinsteiner, the Chancellor of OUS, Kirby Dias, the Vice President, State Board of Higher Ed, and Bill McGee, DAS Budget and Management Division. And if there was somebody I left out, I apologize.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be before you today, make a presentation on behalf of the State Board of Higher Education and the Chancellor's Office and the universities in total. For the record, my name is Henry Lorenzen. I'm president of the State Board of Higher Education. I'm also a lawyer, and I operate a wheat farm in the Pendleton area. Before I get started, it's appropriate that we acknowledge the great tragedy that has occurred at Virginia Tech. It weighs heavily on all of us. Our sympathies go out to all affected, and our prayers do as well. This is particularly poignant for me because I have two daughters in college, and I can't imagine what it would be like to suffer such a tragedy. And to go on to explain a little bit more about my background, there's an old country and western song, enough about you, talk about me. I think it's appropriate. I want to just mention something about my background so that you folks can understand my passion for higher education. I am a first-generation college graduate. And when I attended to Oregon State University 40 years ago, or graduated 40 years ago, that wasn't such a big deal. Most of my fraternity brothers, I believe, also were first-generation college graduates. They were sons of farmers, sons of fishermen, sons of loggers, and daughters as well if they were in the sorority, not in the fraternity. But this was the opportunity for us to have to gain a middle class lifestyle, and it was one that was very affordable. Our previous generations made this an achievable event without having to assume a great deal of debt. I remember I was outraged, I think, and I'm only jokingly say that, but I remember tuition went up 15% one year from $90 a term to $115 a term. And it was the expenses were such that people, my classmates working during the summer at a good job, would make enough money to pay for their tuition and the room and board for a year. This is no longer achievable, obviously, and one of the things that it worries me to a very high degree, because I feel so passionate that higher education is so important for us, and especially as our natural resource industries are on the wane. The second slide, please. The State Board of Higher Education over the last 2 years engaged in a very robust strategic planning process. This was done so that we could more efficiently make certain that we were efficiently deploying our resources and to look at how we were accomplishing our mission overall. In the strategic planning process, we identified very clearly broad goals, operating principles, strategic priorities, all the words that often go with a strategic planning process. And I have to admit, my love is engineering. I'm probably an engineer at heart, and efforts like this at times are difficult for me to engage in because I like very specific hard facts and hard numbers and clear objectives. But it was one that I believe was very, very important, and what we concluded was that it was critical for us to look at the system as a whole and to prioritize or to provide a portfolio approach to our education system, and that we in the next few years will be working very hard to make certain that this portfolio is in fact deployed and implemented, which will hopefully make the delivery of our educational services even more efficient. the one thing that struck us was the great disinvestment that has occurred in higher education over the last 15 years. And the consensus of the board was that this is a trend that was needed to be reversed, and it was critical it be reversed as quickly as we could. Don Blair, who's the CFO of Nike, probably the most astute financial mind on our board, and who always has a very succinct way of describing complex situations, referred to this as a burning platform. And he and that has been, I'll use the phrase, burned into my mind as well, that we are at a critical stage in our higher ed system. The staff in their prepared remarks asked me to say that we were calling for a bold call for investment in Oregon's future. I'd put it a different way. I would say we have a bold call to return to the past in higher education. And what I mean by that, let's return to the past where we are funding higher education at a high level, where we make education affordable and be a high quality and one that will sustain Oregon going into the future. The board, in its strategic planning process and also in developing its budget 2 years ago, looked at what it would take to put us at the average, to put us in the middle. Put us in the middle in terms of faculty salaries, put us in the middle in terms of student-faculty ratios, put us in the middle in terms of supporting our infrastructure and preventing the mounting of deferred maintenance. And in that, we recognize that significant reinvestment would have to occur, and our proposal was to do this over a 10-year period. Our budget, which we proposed to the governor, was a step in the direction. It was not getting us there this year. It was a plan to get us there over a 10-year period. And in the governor, and it's very difficult for me to understand the various the comparison of the various budgets because numbers shift from categories to categories, but broadly speaking, the governor's budget, as he proposed it, was about $50 million less than what the State Board of Higher Education had suggested, and that was a budget that was one tracking as the first down payment out of five to get us to the point where we needed to be 10 years from now so we could be at the average. It's that significant. And then the co-chair's budget, again, reduce that by another $35 million. Slide three, please. And I'm sorry, if I may go back. Let me finish this slide. One of the things that has struck me, when you take a look between 2001 to 2005-07, the reduction in per capita spending for higher education is shown at close to 25%. What is even more startling is if we go back to 1989 to 91, that reduction is a 45% reduction of per capita spending for higher education in the state of Oregon, which is, to me, is startling, and is saddening. This reduction in the, slide three, please. The reduction in higher education, and this may very well be slide three, it results in a declining freshman participation rates. Representative Jensen is fully aware of this issue of many of our very high-achieving students leaving the state of Oregon to attend colleges elsewhere. After the top faculty taking with them high grant dollars and being pirated away by other institutions because we cannot afford to meet and pay competitive salaries. And then the industry, it continues to call for highly educated workers in order to be able to supply their workforce. But Oregon has been blessed, if you call it blessed, we have imported our highly trained workforce from other areas, and that's how we have managed to grow our high-tech industries. But this is something that is not sustainable, and it's something that we should certainly be looking at growing our own, because, and being a father, I'd love to have my own children stay in the state, and also I know the probability is highest if they go to school within the state, and if they will stay here. One of the problems is, and I wouldn't say a problem, our success has been our curse. In the past, we've accomplished great things with diminishing budgets. But this is not sustainable. At some point, it's going to catch up with us. President Ed Ray at Oregon State has said it, I think, very succinctly when we're saying we're on a slow-motion train wreck. This is a sort of thing that will not catch up with us immediately, but with faculty salaries, they're not competitive. As faculty retire, it becomes increasingly difficult to replace them. I'll go through slide four, please. And a question was asked, Senator Morris, whether student enrollment had increased since 1999 with relatively flat enrollment. The FTE increase in students since 1999 has been in the neighborhood of 14,000 students, 13,600 student additional FTEs within the system with flat state enrollment. And this has been met with, in order to maintain the system, even at its existing level, this has been achieved, obviously, by an increase in rate of growth in tuition. And now we're at the point where, in 1999, 26% of the university system's budget was based upon the general fund. Now we're down to mere 16% of the university system's budget comes from the state general fund. And that obviously has resulted.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lanzan.
Thank you. And good afternoon, Henry. It's good to see you here on this side of the mountains. Although I think I sometimes enjoy seeing you and visiting you on the other side of the mountains more than perhaps here. And just one quick sort of thing. Henry said that he was the first person, I think, in his family to graduate from college, and I think that's, I would point out that there was a lot of motivation, I think, in his family as far as education was concerned, because his mother was, at the time, the oldest person to graduate from Blue Mountain Community College with an Associate of Arts degree when I was there. And she was my advisee, and I'm sure that had there been a university a little bit closer, or had we had some of the opportunities that we have today, she would probably have pursued that to a baccalaureate degree. But my question, it had nothing to do with that. My question has to do with are these apples and oranges dollars you got here, or are they constant dollars in your pie charts?
I would have to ask the chancellor here to assist me with that. I do not know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, those are those are not constant dollars.
Okay.
Those are the current dollars in those biennium.
Yeah, okay. That's $99 or $01 and $07.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
I'm close to concluding, and I urge you, and I know you folks feel as strongly about higher education as the State Board of Higher Education does as well. And I also recognize that you are under great restraints with the amount of funds that you have available. But I would urge you to do all you can to assist in increasing the operating budget so that we can move toward providing that dream of higher education that my generation was able to achieve and realize as a result of the investments made by prior generations of what I was able to have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the context of burning platforms and slow-motion train wrecks, could you put in perspective the governor's recommended budget and the co-chair's budget with respect to what really is, kind of might say, the benchmark requirements?
Well, I can make,
as you see this picture.
What we saw was the $50 million difference between what the governor recommended and what the state board recommended was a investment of 1 year. So if you multiply that by five, that's what it gets us to where we ultimately needed to be over a five biennial period. Yeah, is that, would that be close? George is the absolute expert on these numbers, and but my I once had an analysis done with regard to each of the individual items: faculty salary, enrollment growth, student faculty ratio, deferred maintenance, and I'm sorry, the numbers are not jumping out at me right now, but my inclination would be to get us to the point where we ought to be in the middle of the middle. It would take an additional approximate $250 million. That's am I how far off am I, George?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I think Henry is pretty close in that regard. Let's parse it a little bit differently if we might. The governor's recommended budget.
Chancellor Princeton, can you say your name?
For the record, George Pernsteiner, Chancellor of Oregon University System. Thank you for the reminder. Hopefully it won't happen again this session. As Henry noted, the board had a plan over 10 years to bring the university system to the average of investment of all the states in the union in terms of investment per student. The governor was able to propose most of that, about $50 million less, as I recall, than had been requested. So most of what that first installment was. The co-chair's budget, if it stands, reduces by another $35 million the investment that would be made. So while it is still above the essential budget level, it essentially gets us to a point where a 10-year plan would become a 20-year plan if we were to sustain those kinds of investments every year. Roughly, that's what I would say.
I guess just to put on the file for future discussion, because we need to move on here, is at least I need to have a better understanding of what the assumptions are in the social budget level, because that gives the impression that what you're asking for is enhancements over and above what is essential, and these two are not coming together.
Right.
So, to get your point, we need to have some reconciliation of that.
Yes, if I may respond just briefly, part of this increases back to the severe cuts that have been taken in the past that have occurred while at the same time increasing enrollment dramatically. And as a result, the resources have not been there. These are absolute numbers as opposed to numbers per student. And I think that's important to consider as well. And someone, I think, mentioned to me the analogy, and maybe it's a very a crude one, but if somebody is having insufficient nourishment and anorexic, can you afford a 10% increase? It doesn't get you very, very far. And I think that is the problem, is that we're starting at a very low disinvestment position right now. And that's something that is always frustrating with regard to our state budgeting process. And I suppose I would want to look at it more as in terms of this kind of a modified zero-based budgeting process, where you take a look at what should it take to educate students, given our mix, our universities, a mix of majors, and looking across the nation to see who does that in an efficient manner, what does it cost, and that should be our starting point to determine where we should be investing, as opposed to what have we done last year, the year before, and so on.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. Senator Morris, for some context, the essential budget level is what used to be called current service level. And what it simply is a projection into the new biennium of the legislatively approved program level from the current biennium. So in this case, it doesn't include enrollment growth. It doesn't include a change in student-faculty ratio. It doesn't include moving faculty salaries to a higher level compared to peers. So those, in fact, are enhancements. But from the board standpoint, I think those are things they feel are essential in order to provide quality higher education for the students, but they would not fit under what is called essential budget level now, which used to be and probably is more understandably termed current service level.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much,
Chancellor. Thank you, Chair DeLizio. Again, for the record, George Pernsteiner, Chancellor of Oregon University System. I want to talk with you a little bit today about the governor's recommended budget, the context of it, the effect of it. It is a budget about our future. It is, I believe, an investment in hope, an investment in belief, a belief in our state and in ourselves as Oregonians. And it departs from the standard approach of essential budget level in an important way. The board last year said to the governor, and the governor in his proposed budget to you agreed, that the way that we budget currently, the support we have currently for our universities and their students is not adequate. It does not reach the level of what is really essential. The board, in defining what was really essential, took a look at what other states were doing. They took a look at what the cost drivers were in this state. They took a look at the aspirations that this state had to create an educated citizenry by the year 2025. And they said to the governor, if this is what you want, governor, if you want Oregonians to have the same kinds of opportunities as people in other states and in other countries have, then you need to provide additional state support. That is what the requested budget from the State Board of Higher Education was premised on. It was not premised on just rolling up the current inadequate appropriation level. And I think, to Senator Morse's question, that really is the biggest distinction between the budget as proposed both by the board and the governor and the essential budget level as it is defined in the current way that the state does budgeting. And it's a fundamental difference that says, that rejects the notion that what we do today is good enough. Because I would submit that what we do today is not good enough. And it's not good enough for our students, it's not good enough for our universities, and it's not good enough for our future as Oregonians. Now, a lot of you know that I grew up working on the very farms and forests of the inland northwest that Henry talked about. You know, back over there where it doesn't rain very much, over the other side of the mountains. I learned quite young that you can't just plant a seed in the field or put a seedling on a hillside and walk away and expect a bountiful harvest of grain or timber. It doesn't work that way. Now, my first resort, being a good rural guy, as all good rural guys do, when you plant it, you worry about it. There is not a farmer, there is not a forester in this world whose first resort is not to worry. They all worry. And, of course, I worried. That was the first thing I do. You plant something, and then you worry. But I also learned that that wasn't enough. Worrying was not enough. So I learned that I had to fertilize those fields, had to irrigate those crops, had to thin those trees, if I wanted to be able to count on that harvest. And I had to tend those crops right up until the harvest. Walking away in the August heat and letting them wilt was not going to result in a harvest in September. I believe the same is true of human capital. It must be tended, and nurtured if it is to yield the bountiful harvest of good citizenship and economic prosperity. And it must be tended and nurtured constantly for it to reach its potential. You can't do it episodically. You have to do it continuously. You can't come in one year and make an investment and walk away in the next and say, oh, we'll catch up some other time. All of our communities in Oregon, I don't care if in North Portland or North Bend, I don't care if in the Ferry Street Bridge or in Echo or Hillsboro or Canyonville, all Oregon communities need their human capital to be developed fully if they are to reap the rewards of their citizens' potential. Economic vitality for a community or a county already seems linked to educational attainment. As the map shows, the adult population in many of Oregon's rural counties is only half as likely to have a college degree as their counterparts in the more urban portions of the state. That means that they are less likely to have in their communities the doctors, the dentists, the nurses, the bankers, the teachers, the veterinarians, the engineers, the technology specialists, all the people who are so essential to the prosperity and the quality of life in the 21st century. It also means that companies who are looking to locate or to grow may pass these communities by because the communities do not have the same educated workforce and service infrastructure enjoyed in more urban parts of the state. You can see from the next chart that Oregon's older adult population, upon whose skills our current economy and standard of living are based,
is better educated than the younger workforce coming up to succeed them. In fact, if you take a close look at the chart, you'll see that there's only four or five states in the country that have a disparity as great as Oregon's. So that at a time when education is widely seen as the key to global competitiveness, Oregon's workforce is becoming less well-educated, meaning that we will have trouble even maintaining our current standard of living going into the future. We do not have the educated workforce to succeed the baby boomers as they retire. Every generation in American history has been better educated than its parents. That is no longer true for the current generation of young Oregonians. Further, we have one of the most rapidly aging populations in the country. It's forecast that by 2025, there will be only three other states that will have a higher proportion of their people age 60 and over, as Oregon will. So not only have we not educated our younger adults, but we will have a higher share of older adults than will almost any other state in the country. Now, we do have advantages. Unlike some states, our younger population is actually growing, and there are states in the Midwest and some in the East where that is not true. So we do have citizens and workforce in waiting, ready to be educated, ready to be trained, ready to come into their own as the workforce that will support this state, its economy, and its society in the 21st century. But these young people are much more likely to be from segments of our society who have not traditionally attended college, such as Latinos, who within 10 years are expected to comprise one-fourth of the high school graduates in Oregon in that year. These young people will need levels of assistance and service for them to attend and succeed in college that are different than those needed by high school graduates who went to college in the 60s, the 70s, or the 80s. Simply put, we're facing a crisis. We have a rapidly aging population. We have a less educated younger workforce. We have a different demography for the youth who are coming up who will go into the workforce in the future. And we are faced with the specter and the opportunity of global competition. Businesses in this state have excelled in their ability to profit in a global economy. But they have done so based on the workforce skills of the people we have in our workforce today. Skills that exceed, for the older population, the educational attainment that the younger population will be bringing into the workforce over the next several years. I cannot help but worry about the continued competitiveness of Oregon businesses in the global economy as we look forward. Henry has shown you how Oregon disinvested in higher education over a 15-year period. Someone asked, what was the effect of that? Someone said to me once, there was no effect of budget cuts. Your institutions are still open. Yes, they're open. They're financially fragile, but they're open. But I would submit to you that the real effect is shown in the chart which illustrates that a smaller proportion of our young people in the workforce have a college degree, an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a professional degree, than for the older workforce. In other words, what we did is we did not educate a whole generation of Oregonians in the 90s and in the early part of this decade. We let, for most of those years, the enrollment of our institutions fall far below what it should have been in order to keep our workforce and our citizenry at the levels of education that would ensure that they would be able to sustain even our current economic context, much less a more competitive situation in the future. But let me show you, though, what happens when the state does invest in higher education. We have proof positive that state investment can make a difference, raising hope and success for Oregonians. The legislature's investment in 1999 raised the hopes of Oregonians and increased the capacity of its universities. The results included an unprecedented increase in the rate at which Oregonians elected to go to college, coming out of high school and enrolling in an OUS institution. It's the biggest increase in freshman participation rate in a short period of time that we've ever seen. And that included a big increase as well among those high school graduates who were at the top of their classes throughout the state. So not only did more of the students went to college, but more of the best students went to college in Oregon. These students were armed with their hope and their belief in this state and in its future. And they believed that this state would help them achieve that future and that they would be linked to this state throughout their lives. So they stayed here, even when the cuts began. And they stayed in college at a higher rate than did their predecessors, and they graduated from college at a higher rate than did their predecessors. So in other words, that investment brought in more students, it brought in more good students, it led to students who stayed, and it led to students who graduated. Now, with the budget reductions of the past several years, we have begun to see the freshman participation rate fall off fairly dramatically. And for the first time this fall, for the first time in many years, the retention rate is dropping too. And I worry what that means for the graduation rate as the full impact of the budget cuts of the next few years rolls out for that smaller group of students than we've seen. Budget cuts year in and year out do affect Oregonians' ability to enter and remain at our universities. But they also affect what Oregonians believe about the quality and sustainability of those universities. We have seen funding and hope and belief decline. The governor's recommended budget arrests that decline and begins to restore hope. It restores hope for affordability through the shared responsibility model, which I know you've already considered, which gives the promise of affordability to every Oregonian. It restores affordability through the board's choice to hold the increase in resident undergraduate tuition to the rate of growth of Oregon family and Oregon household income. It restores quality by a reinvestment primarily in our principal asset, which is our faculty, paying them better and attracting more of them, reducing class sizes, increasing the opportunities for research. And it restores hope in the sustainability of our institutions, both through providing dollars to ensure that those who are the most financially fragile can continue and can continue to offer excellent programs, but also in reinvesting in aging and failing facilities. With state reinvestment comes more than hope, though. As proven by the state's investment in 1999, it also pays off with more degrees, nurturing Oregonians to be successful and to contribute to making the economy and civic life of every community in this state more vibrant and more sustainable. Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor Flynn Center. I don't know if there are any questions for Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And George and Henry, in terms of the premise, I couldn't more strongly agree with you that sustained investment is perhaps the best model one can follow for economic growth and economic development. How would you guys, and Kirby, I don't know if you're up day two on this. I think you've worked on this issue.
She's up next.
Are you up next?
I am.
Well, maybe I'll put the question out there and allow whoever within the board or the chancellor to answer it. But how would you respond to the question that the board, given the fiscal past of this state in terms of investment, and you detailed it, that we have made, or perhaps the board has not made, the tough choices to invest whatever the resources are, from tuition, from state support, into excellence? And I looked at Mr. Bender's handout and looked at new campus that I would argue, I think folks might argue, is unsustainable, or at least an expansion in Bend, and other decisions. And I guess I would put that question out to whomever wants to take it from the board or from the chancellor's office. Have we really looked at how do our role, hopefully, as sustained investment, continued investment, getting towards closer to the governor's level of funding? How does the board and the chancellor, long-winded question, get at that, really taking those dollars and investing in excellence and getting us and making tough decisions and saying no to folks and saying no to expansions and duplication in other areas so that we really can invest in what we're great at and grow that enrollment?
Mr. Chair, I think Henry and Kirby may want to respond also, but if I might first, Mr. Chair, Senator Decker. The board has done several things that I think are noteworthy. The first is, in its request to the governor, it did not automatically just cede forward everything everybody wanted. They looked carefully at what they thought would be essential to provide for the state as a whole and the university system as a whole, a level of resources adequate to be able to educate the next generation of Oregonians. That's where this 10-year plan came from. So that was the first premise. The second was, as Don Blair indicated, before you can begin to make the improvements, you have to put out the fire in the burning platform. And that's part of what this budget also did, is to put out the fire in the burning platform. The third thing, and it's going on right now, is that the board is engaged in a very careful review of the missions and the programs of each of the seven universities. And they're doing that in the context of looking at what they believe is needed over the next 20 years in terms of capacity and program in this state, and looking at who does what best, and trying to make a determination about how best to meet the overall needs of the state. That determination, I mean, they're going to spend this entire year working with the seven campuses, looking at individual programs, looking particularly at the concern about duplication of graduate programs, for example. And I think those things are important and will result in, I think, some very hard choices that will be made with respect to certain programs on certain campuses before that process is over.
I'll mention just something quickly, although Kirby is the one that always seems to get the sound bites in this area with her comments about closing campuses and so on, which I'm not nearly as good at getting the press coverage as she is, but so as a result, with some degree of trepidation, I'll make a comment here. One of the things often we look at and often focus upon, what would happen if we closed a regional campus? Let's say that we would look at that. The costs do not go away. The cost, if we assume that we still want to educate those students, accommodations would have to be made at other universities, which then would require expanding classes or else either increasing student-faculty ratio even higher, which also then would drive up the graduation rates. Time to graduation. One of the things, in the chart that was handed out, and it just shows a dilemma that's faced. You look over my side of the mountains, Eastern Oregon University, the funding per fundable FTE at close to $5,300 per student. A cold-hearted analyst might say, well, that is absolutely inefficient. We should close down Eastern. But what would that mean then in terms of the opportunity for some students from Halfway or for Cove and those sort of things to be able to get a college degree? And I can tell you that one of my first duties when I came on the Board of Higher Education was to attend the graduation ceremony and assist in handing out the diplomas at Eastern Oregon University. And I'll tell you, it was really heartwarming to see the kids there and the testimonials about how they would not have been able to obtain a college degree if they had not had that opportunity. That is something that's very, very difficult to balance, but our challenge is to make certain that we deliver that educational resource in those areas in the most efficient way and to pare down the number of programs so that those that are offered are the ones that are in highest demand, and we can do that by in that manner, doing it and most efficiently.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I guess the chancellor's questions directed, and maybe it's going to be addressed a little more later, but. I see you've done, you know, a certain amount of work here in relationship to some data for us, and I'm interested, based on what the given co-chair's budget is, what the impact of that will be on tuition and on enrollment. In the immediate future, and perhaps even how that extends out. I'm curious whether you've done any or can do any kind of modeling, you know, on this, so we could have some idea of you know what happens with this train when the track gets narrower and narrower and the wheels stay the same width, sort of thing. So I don't know whether that's a fair question. I don't know whether you have it or not, but if you do, it really would be helpful to me at any rate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, basically I think you've asked for two things. One is, what kind of tuition increase above the median family income level, which is what our budget was premised on, would be required to restore to the reductions the co-chairs have proposed. And that's about 5.5% per year above where it currently is forecast to be. And that's on resident undergraduate students, who are the ones that we're talking about here. So that's a fairly noticeable increase. We propose about 3.4% per year, and this would run at right around 9% per year in order to restore that $35 million. The second question is, what might that do to enrollment? That's a little more difficult to assess. There are some models out there that would suggest, and we can refine this, that would suggest that we'd probably lose 400 or 500, maybe even as many as 600 students over the biennium from where we otherwise would have been. You know, the last time I had to do this analysis was right after Measure 5, and we lost 6,000 students right then, and you saw the impact of having lost that level of students, because that's the main reason why the young population of this state is not as well educated as their elders. It's because we didn't educate them, because we dropped them out of the system with the big tuition increases in the early 1990s. So I'm very concerned, you know, again, this isn't of the same magnitude as that, but I'm very concerned about anything that drives down enrollment at a time when I think it's essential for the state to be increasing enrollment. So my guess, and it's just a guess, is somewhere between 400 and 600 students if we were to raise tuition to that roughly 9 plus 9 level. But we can refine those numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the two of you. Appreciate it.
Stay close. I'll show you what we can. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Kirby Dias, and I'm the Vice President of the Board of Higher Education. I think most notably, people will look at my career and say, well, gee, she spent 23 years in the Intel Corporation, and I actually joined that corporation when it was a medium-sized company, not a large company. So I got a chance to see a very, very large business grow in Oregon. It was kind of interesting to watch and interesting to see how they tapped into the educational system in order to do that. I now invest in small startup companies, and it's been a real good week for me because I've got two of them that have paid off as an investment. I've got 14 little companies, all but one of them is in Oregon. And two of them this last week did very well, and I got more than my money back. So I'm here to tell you that things are going well. I'm a little worried about the future, but they're going well right at the moment. So that's a little bit about my background. And just to mention Henry's comment, I'm a first-generation college student, too, as are my three brothers. So, you know, higher education is a life-changing moment. It is the inspiration for the K-12 organization and students. And if you don't have it, I'm a little concerned about the future that we have. And part of that educational system is frankly, the heart and soul of the institution is really its faculty. And I've been fortunate over the last couple of years because I ran a committee of the board called Academic Excellence and Economic Development. And one of the things that I got a chance to do is visit all the campuses a number of times and spend some time getting to know our faculty and what they were about and what they're like. And I guess I had this perspective that, you know, they were probably more arrogant and they were, you know, not in touch with business and all these sorts of things. And the reality is that was not what I found at all. What I found is a very entrepreneurial faculty. I found a faculty that is doing more with less than any faculty in the U.S., and I would probably put them against a number of the faculty that are outside the U.S. as well. They are incredibly efficient, and they're effective, but we are burning them up. We've got a ratio that is higher than any other state in the union at this point of students to faculty members. And I know it doesn't sound large in terms of classrooms, but frankly, the faculty are key and on first base in advising students. Students go to faculty first. I mean, all the student surveys have told us that. It's the faculty members that change lives for our students. And investing in faculty just makes an awful lot of sense. And we're falling way behind. We invest at a lower level, so our salaries are lower. We increase enrollment because we have a demand in the state, and you know, our students aren't having any problem at all finding jobs, so that's not the issue. And it's an untenable ratio that we're building, and something we're going to have to do something about. And one of the things that I've been fortunate enough to do here recently is be in on a couple of accreditation visits. And as I was telling George earlier today, I have a feeling we're going to get visited every single year now. And the reason is because most of these accreditation visits take one look at two things: our funding and the fact that it's not sustainable for most of our institutions, and some of our favorites are not going to be sustainable if we don't do something different. And the second thing is the lack of control that the actual president has over their destiny. I mean, we don't give them a tremendous amount of control, nor do we give the State Board of Education a lot of control over our own destiny. A lot of our expenses are dictated to us because they're state expenses. And the other thing that was just kind of noteworthy is if you look at how much of the general fund is going into higher education, that amount is about what it takes to fund the benefits programs and the allocation expenses from the state. So we're basically in a circle here. We're just supporting our state-dictated benefits, etc. Our benefits for our faculty are 47%. Other states are at someplace between 25 and 30%. So it's, you know, we've got a real interesting dilemma, and I'm not suggesting we change how we do benefits, but I am suggesting that if we're going to do those robust benefits, then we have to support them. We have to fund them. And we're not funding anything else at this point, and that benefit cost goes up very, very significantly every year, about 9%.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you. Ms. Dias, the issue around the overall cost of the faculty is one that interests me. And I am curious because I think that it is very well documented that the loading costs on our salaries are substantially more than pretty much any other state, and that we have significantly higher costs in health insurance and retirement benefits than any other state, and that because we have to put so much of our resources into those areas, we don't have the ability to put the salaries up to where they are to reach a national model. What are of the discussions that the board is entering into on potential remedies to that? I mean, it's a pretty defined box that you're in, and it seems that if you consider the overall compensation package, you'd be looking at it from a different perspective than if you just consider the salary component and compare it.
Representative Morgan and Mr. Chair, we have been considering this a great deal, and I've got a chart later on in my presentation where, if you'll bear with me for a moment, I'll show you what the overall total cost of compensation, for instance, for our faculty at this point, which is frankly still below the average. So even on a total comp perspective, we're not meeting the requirements. But the other thing that I would comment on is, as you start to attract new faculty, the things that attract new faculty are very similar to the things I'm finding, the things that attract your best employees in a company. It is base salary. At the end of the day, it is the dollars and cents. It's not the benefits package in almost all cases. And so while you may have faculty that depend on those benefits today, attracting new faculty, which is where the board has been proposing changing our benefits program and putting more into faculty salaries and less into benefits, I think we could attract the best faculty. And we're having a difficult time getting top faculty, and some of our searches, about 30% of them are not, I mean, we can't complete them because we can't find people that will come to our universities to work for the salaries that we're willing to pay. And I think that's a real concern. Let me go on and I'll show you the chart. I think that might be helpful. Let me talk a little bit about the faculty interaction in general. Obviously, it's not just in the classroom, as I mentioned before. It's really outside the classroom. That is where the faculty students having coffee, the faculty and students having meetings together, the faculty and students doing things together is where that interaction makes a tremendous difference. Not that the classroom isn't important, but that's not where all the real meaningful discussions about career and majors and minors and all that sort of stuff actually take place. The other thing that's very, very interesting is if you look at the ratio of students to faculty and you diminish that ratio, you generally get better course completion because, again, you have that engagement. You get persistence from the freshman to the sophomore year. I think, from my standpoint, it's criminal in this state to think that we don't have persistence between the freshman and sophomore year. That just means we funded a student for a freshman year. And that doesn't give them any of those job-ready skills to go out and earn a living wage, a family living wage. So, I mean, it just seems like we're throwing money when we do things like that. I mean, we need to be able to fund the institution in such a way that we've got a ratio that allows the students to get all the way through. And I think that's very, very critical. But it's not just the starting, it's the finishing that makes a tremendous difference in the employability of our students. Graduation rates, as I mentioned, GPAs, jobs, faculty are tremendous in introducing the students to potential employers. You're on. Over on to the salary. Okay. Let me talk about our salaries. As this chart shows, we're running into a huge issue in salary, just base salary. As you can see, we're at the bottom of the stack across the board. If you look at total compensation, and this takes into effect all of our benefits programs as well as our retirement programs, which are very robust compared to other states, per Representative Morgan's comment, it is. And again, we don't have a copay. We don't have any sharing of those expenses with the recipients in for any of our state employees, which I believe there's one, maybe two other states that don't share expenses today. The rest of them all have some shared expenses at this point. But again, you can't just start doing that and not do something about the base salaries. The base salaries at the end of the day are what attracts your top faculty. And, our faculty that are here are very, very dedicated, and thank goodness they're dedicated to Oregon or they have families here and they don't want to leave. because some of them, as they get tapped for searches, faculty searches from other institutions, I mean, the differential that they can get going elsewhere is very, very significant. And I can assure you, they leave the benefits package, and they do it all the time. Does that respond to your question, Representative Moore?
Well, I think what it does is it does a good job of outlining the problem, but it doesn't get me really any closer to trying to... I mean, the obvious answer is to shovel a bunch of money in the front end of the system, but our ability to do that is obviously impacted by some fairly complex issues. So I'm just curious as to whether there is any room to work with the benefit package and allow the university to free up some capital from the way that that's structured that you can reapply into salaries, and what the discussion is within the system to that end.
Well, obviously, and this comes from a long line of just my working with employees in general, but you don't take benefits away from employees that are existing in the system. It doesn't make any sense, and it's probably not a good idea, particularly if you're not going to offset that with increases in salary immediately. And as you mentioned, I think the budget to do that is probably pretty significant. However, for people coming into the system, you can change the ratio and put more in base salary and put less in benefits coming into the system. And eventually that works through the system and you end up, you know, on a more even keel with other states. So we've looked at, you know, situations of doing that and what the savings could be and what the, you know, potential could be for our employees.
If I might,
sure.
Do the you're involved in PEB and PERS?
Yes.
What are the discussions around being able to modify your commitments to those programs to allow you to offer different benefits to new employees?
Oh, very honestly, they haven't been. What would I say?
Welcomed.
And again, I you know, it's not that I can't see why. The faculty and the university employees are a very healthy population in general. And so the question is, you know, if you take them out, what do you do with the other spread of the of that expense? I can understand both sides of it, but by the same token, you've got a university system that we are slowly but surely taking apart, brick by brick, and we've been doing it over the last 15 years. Most of our voters, I don't think, have a clue that that's what we've been doing. At least the ones I talk to don't have any idea that's what we've been doing, but that's what we've been doing. And now we're at a point where we're so low compared to other states. I mean, we get written up for being that low on a pretty regular basis. And as I said, with the accreditation visits where you know, all of the university folks from other states come to visit our universities to look at our accreditation, they see the same thing we see. And, you know, so I think... I'm not sure you can take on the benefits program or benefits situation until you say, gee, I've got to have some minimum funding to start to take the salaries up so I can hire some good faculty. Maybe at that same time you can actually start to change the benefits program going in. But there's a lot of negotiation, I think, between what we'd love to see happen and having it happen.
Well, and if I might again.
Mm-hmm. I would just note that we have about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Because we have a floor session at 4:30.
That's right, we do. Even when you compare the total compensation to where that puts you with comparable institutions, it's still not, I mean, there's a couple of them where it makes an appreciable difference.
I agree.
But a bunch of them where it doesn't. And kind of where I was going with this was it doesn't appear to me, because of the dynamic of PERS and PEB, that OUS is going to be able to escape those two systems. And it has to do with the overall stability of the larger systems as much as with, you know, the cost of it.
Well, in that case, though,
The part that I am interested in would be, what are we looking at in terms of an investment here to bring our salaries, our total compensation package, up to where we are, you know, somewhere towards the middle? What does that look like in terms of an investment?
Representative Morgan and Mr. Chair,
it's around 50 million.
Yeah, I was close. It's around 50 million. And that was certainly the higher education proposal, and you know, first step to that was in our proposal to the governor. And there was a difference between the governor's budget, as mentioned before, and our proposal to the governor. I mean, our proposal was essentially about $5.3 million over on faculty salaries, what his budget encompassed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen, do you
want to... I just want to very quickly follow this with, a request. I'd like to see, I mean, I see some ranking accorded type of thing with other comparable institutions. I haven't the vaguest idea who those comparable institutions are or what they are. And I don't know, we could be 11th out of 13 and be $500 difference in, so that doesn't tell me a lot type of thing. I'd like to see numbers that go with is what we're talking about in terms of total salary and salary with compensation compared to Duke University with salary and salary with
that'll be depressing.
Don't you beat them regularly in basketball? My memory isn't real good here as I get older.
Just
but,
not
you
in
know.
Salary.
Okay. Coaches don't make as much here, I understand, as they do there.
Go down that road. That's a real scary one.
So, Representative Jensen and Mr. Chair, I'm sure we can pull that together.
Thank you.
I looked at them.
It'd help me.
The names. Yeah, I agree.
So, Ms. Dias, it looks like I think we've come to the end for today. So I don't know if are you coming back tomorrow? Or?
I'm not, but you'll get a few,
okay.
few more.
I think because it's a little unusual that we're having a floor session for the House. So thank you very much for today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing, and we are adjourned.